Hi everyone, welcome to the Idiots Podcast, that's infectious disease insight of two specialists. I'm James, that's Callum, and we're going to tell you everything you need to know about infectious disease.
Soon may the editing come to discontinue the Tazo Sun. One day when the CRP's done, we'll take our leave and go.
Hey, how are you doing?
I'm fine, Callum. My clothes are feeling a little bit scratchy. I had to use the non-biological washing powder this evening because there was no bio available. And that reminds me, Callum.
I'm not sure where that was going.
That reminds me, Callum. What are we talking about today?
We're not talking about anything. We're blethering about bioavailability.
Oh, that's right, Callum. It's a pharmacokinetics mini-series. It's finally here, by chance to shine.
Yeah, what they said when he set off on his training journey, they said, RD pharmacology, that's a weird CCT. Little did they know that all of James' training was just for this moment in the sun, where he gets to wax lyrical about PK pharmacokinetics, and nobody can stop him. Well, apart from you, loyal listener, by stopping listening.
Well, I mean, or you could edit all of it out, but it would be a real short episode after that.
Yeah.
Well, so why are we doing this, Callum? I think that when it comes to infectious disease, the pharmacokinetics and the pharmacodynamics of the antibiotic are more important and to understand than other drug classes. And now, why do I say that, Callum? The PK of most drugs has been worked out in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. It's been well known for decades. So, for example, furosemide, it's 50% bioavailable. People have known that for ages. And so that means that people dose it accordingly, and then when you move from oral to IV, you get a sort of a doubling of its effect. And that would be part of the justification for moving from oral to double. But really, there's a lot of drugs where the regimens have been set because they're known bioavailability, absorption, distribution, and sort of half-life and elimination is well known. So you know that you can just dose lisinopril once a day, but there are some other drugs that you might have to dose two or three times a day. But antibiotics are not like other drug classes because they stop working sometimes if you don't dose them right, if you underdose them. And some of them are excessively toxic as well. Here I'm just talking about effectiveness. And leveraging your knowledge about the PK of antibiotics can make you a better infectious disease doctor. So that's why I wanted to just dive into the pharmacokinetics of antibiotics and tell people what I think they need to know for that reason. So I think we're going to do this in two stages. First is that we're going to talk about bioavailability in general and how the drugs get into the body. And then we're going to talk about some sort of fun facts about antibiotics absorption. Question from the audience?
So we did an episode recently which was choosing an antimicrobial.
Yeah. That sort of inspired me to do this, actually.
Well, yeah, and I think that was a very basic overview. Well, maybe it was, I don't know, it was high-level discussion about choosing an antibiotic. And I think I was reflecting on that afterwards and I was like, well, if we got more complicated and divided it up, the way that you can think about choosing your antibiotic is there's host factors. So that would be is the oral route available? What allergies and tolerances the patient have?
Renal failure, obesity, pregnancy.
Yeah, exactly. So things that are specific to that person, and their preferences as well, obviously. Then there's bug factors. Do you have the organism, yes or no? If you do, then do you have the sensitivity data? What are those? What expected phenotypes might you see? And there's a whole load of discussion that can go on there about civics of bacteria, like the UCAS expected phenotypes document, for example. And then there's drug factors. And I think the drug factors is probably the most complicated bit. Like, obviously, the bug bit is also very complicated, although when you're working clinically, the complicated lab stuff, hopefully your lab has done that right and you've got the results, so you can just say, okay, I can trust that the lab's got that there. It's not quite as simple as that, and I think maybe we'll come back to that. But I'm really interested in some of the stuff that James got to say about that those drug factors. So when you're choosing an antibiotic, and that's probably the thing that's most important out of the three of them. Maybe I won't say that. Take that back, Cal.
Yeah, so, no, take that back, because it's the susceptibility is the most important thing.
Well, I actually think the patient's preferences are the most important. James.
You're so woke, Callum. So anyway, let's talk about bioavailability. So let's start with a quick definition, which I think most people will know. So bioavailability is the relative amount of a drug that will reach the systemic circulation if given orally compared to if it was given IV at the same dosage. Historically, here's how you do this. You get a bunch of medical students, usually, and you will give them a pill, and you will measure the concentration in plasma over lots of different time periods. And then you will do the same thing with the same dosage, only this time you will inject it. And you will get two different concentration time curves, and you will measure the AUC, area under curve, of each. And then you will compare the oral one to the IV one. Usually they won't be exactly the same. And say only 4/5 of the oral dose gets into the plasma, then you will have an 80% bioavailable drug. And in order for the drug to get into the plasma, it has to be ingested, transited to the GI tract, absorbed in almost definitely the small intestine, and then undergo first pass metabolism with CYP isoenzymes that happens mostly in the liver, but also in the small intestinal mucosa.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, and so the bioavailability, it's used to determine the ideal route to get the therapeutic concentration, because of course after it's absorbed it has to go to the target site and kill the bug, and the amount of drug that needs to be given in order to sort of achieve this. And so give me an example of a drug that's not very bioavailable. I would tell you gentamicin. No, it's not really absorbed from the GI tract, it's too polar, and you wouldn't give it orally, you would give it IV. So I'm going to take you through each stage bit by bit, Callum, and give you a little bit of what you need to know. Now, this is, I think, more than you need to know. And now that you've passed the part two, of course, you need never learn anything ever again. But this, I'm telling you more than you need to know so that you can remember bits of it that might be interesting or come up in pub quizzes. Okay?
What sort of pub quizzes are you going to? But okay, I'm looking forward to the day this comes up in a pub quiz.
Fantastic. So in terms of oral absorption in the GI tract, once a drug gets ingested, not much of it will be absorbed from the stomach. It's got this thick mucus layer that stops the stomach acid from killing the stomach epithelial cells, and that also prevents significant drug absorption. It's also not got much of a surface area. It's about 1 meter squared, whereas the small intestine, it's tailor-made for absorbing stuff, because that's its job, it absorbs food. And so it's got a surface area of about 30 to 35 meters squared, and that's because it's got the leaky circulari, which are those folds which increase the surface area, and epithelia villi and microvilli, and they're increasing the surface area almost 100-fold. From compared to if they weren't there. And so it also had a longish transit time, so it's about 4 to 6 hours, and the whole small intestine is about 6 to 7 meters long. And so all that gives it plenty of time to absorb lots of stuff, and sort of peristalsis is happening to bring the food contents, but also the drug, in regular contact with the intestinal wall to allow absorption to happen. And the other interesting thing is that unlike the stomach, which is quite acidic, the small intestine is weakly acidic. And because of the pK of most drugs, that means that makes them exist in both an ionized and non-ionized state. And there's different absorption methods which will pick up either of those drugs in either of those states.
And just to expand on that slightly, the pH, so the relative acidity of environment changes how much of a drug is ionized, so has a charged, and non-ionized.
Yeah,
and that'll be different between, like, different, you know, that'll be a drug to drug specific thing.
Yes, it will. So I've actually got a little note on this that I've in the prep notes that I've included as a drop down note. But basically, drugs are usually weak acids or weak bases, and so their rate of uptake, certainly passive uptake, is determined by their ionized versus unionized state. So if you're an acidic drug, then you can release an H+ ion and you will go, then you will adopt a negative charge. So you will be a negatively charged acidic drug plus H+. And if you're a basic drug, then you can accept an H+, and you will go from being basic to be a base drug which has a H+ attached to it. And this is called a protonated base, right? Because it's got a proton, it's got an extra proton, because an H+ ion is just a proton.
Yeah.
And the pK of a molecule is the, from taking acids for a second, the pK of an acid is the pH at which the acid will exist in a 50% ionized and 50% unionized form.
What's a pKa? Sorry, just what does that mean?
pK of the acid.
But what does pKa stand for?
It is the pH at which it's 50-50 ionized to unionized.
Oh, I see. So it's not the standard.
And pKb is the same for bases.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And the thing to know is that ionized drugs can't diffuse through a lipid bilayer. So the lipid bilayer is specifically to keep out ionized molecules. But unionized drugs do that. So if you've got, say, an acid which still has its spare hydrogen ion attached to it, it's not ionized, and then it will diffuse across the lumen. Whereas if it's given up that H and it's negatively charged, it's not going to do that. But it can combine with free H+ in order to become acidified and then can move across. And the reverse being true for bases. So protonated bases can't cross lipid bilayers. That's brings me to the four methods by which things transit the GI epithelium into the bloodstream, and the first of which is passive diffusion. And most small molecules, less than 500 Daltons, that aren't strong ionic, do that.
And what's a Dalton?
A Dalton's a unit of measurement that's a 12th of a carbon atom.
So it's a measurement of molecular
size. It's a measurement of molecular size. Most molecules are measured in kilodaltons because they're bigger than 1,000 Daltons. Yeah.
So less than 500 Daltons is quite a small drug.
It is, yes. So small drugs will cross that, and unionized drugs and lipophilic drugs, things like steroids, they will pass just through a lipid bilayer as if it doesn't exist. And then the second way that a small molecule can get across, if you're lipophobic, so if you're a protonated base or you're a acid that gave up its H+, is that you can do something called facilitated diffusion. And so this is where a proton will help the molecule cross, and it will happen across an electrochemical concentration gradient. And at this point, Callum, I have to tell you about SLCs. Do you know what SLCs are?
Yes, they're solute carrier transporters. Of course I know that. Everyone knows that.
Okay, fair enough.
I just read that.
Fine. You probably have heard of OAT transporters, though, in the kidney. Sometimes this is a way that drugs can react. For example, probenecid is sometimes given alongside beta-lactams to boost their plasma concentration. We're doing that more and more down in NAIDOS Royal Infirmary South. How it works is that probenecid is preferentially excreted outside of in the OAT transporter out into the urine. And that means that the beta-lactam is not, and so the beta-lactam level stays high in the plasma. Hmm. So OAT stands for organic ion transporter, and there's OCTs, which are organic cation transporters. And organic ion transporters, or OATs, will carry deprotonated acids, so acids that have given up an H+, and OCTs will carry protonated bases. And this group, there's about 350 of them, solute carrier transporters. They're divided into OATs and OCTs, and they do some other stuff as well, which we're going to come on to. But if they're passively just helping a small molecule get across a lipid bilayer, it will do so by moving it from where there's lots of them to where there's little of them. And so that will help diffusion across into the bloodstream.
Hmm.
And then the third method is active transport. You probably know about active transport. It involves the use of energy or an exchange of ions or cone transport of a negatively charged ion with a positively charged thing or vice versa. There's two kinds. One is primary, and usually that's actually doesn't have a big, isn't involved in drug uptake. It's mostly the efflux of drugs from specific body compartments or cell out of that compartment. But secondary active transport is how ionized drugs tend to be absorbed, and SLCs do that as well. Again, it's across pre-existing electrochemical gradients, and they will be co-transported with a suitably ionized thing. So our example for this from the antibiotic world is hydrogen ions will be co-transported with beta-lactam antibiotics, which are negatively charged. And then the last transport mechanism is pinocytosis. So this is the endocytosis, or occasionally the exocytosis, of large molecules, where the cell membrane will invaginate and then just suck up proteins that happen to be in the local area, or occasionally it's receptor-mediated, the endocytosis. And then they will be pinched off into a vesicle, and that vesicle can then transport across the cell and go into the bloodstream. This is more important in places like the blood-brain barrier, where otherwise there's tight junctions that prevent diffusion of the antibiotic or the drug into the brain for obvious reasons. But yeah, any questions on that, Cal?
So just to summarise, because that is quite a lot that is new to me, or I haven't thought about in a long time.
More information than you need to know, but why don't you go through the table at the top?
Yeah, so there's four methods of transit of drugs. We're thinking specifically about transiting the GI epithelium into the bloodstream, but this is sort of general principles anyway. Okay, so there's four methods. Method one is passive diffusion. So that's small molecules less than 500 Daltons that are lipophilic and are not ionic. And then there's number two, facilitated diffusion. So that's small molecules less than 500 Daltons that are lipophobic and are ionic drugs. So your deprotonated acids and your protonated bases. And that's carried out by your SLCs, solute carrier transporters. The third one is active transport. That's your ionized drugs. And there's two types. One is primary active transport, which is mostly efflux, and secondary active transport, and that's how most ionized drugs are absorbed, and that's again carried out by your SLCs, solute carrier transporters, and those are made up of your OATs and your OCTs, and they're co-transported. And then the final one is pinocytosis, and that's where your large molecules are transported, and that's mainly across tissue barriers, e.g. the blood-brain barrier, an endo or exocytosis.
Like we said, this is probably more information than you need to know, but I think it's interesting to good to have a refresher of exactly how stuff is getting in to the bloodstream. And then the last thing that we're going to talk about is first pass metabolism. And a small amount of this happens in the gut epithelia before entering the portal vein, but most of it occurs in the liver, and that's done almost exclusively by CYP450 isoenzymes in the hepatocytes. So that the drug will, as it's passing through the liver, it diffuses into the hepatocytes, gets metabolized, and then gets broken down. But some of it will not, and some of it will just pass through and then hit the bloodstream. And that is what you're measuring when you measure the plasma availability.
Yeah.
So that's it for part one. Part two is going to be a talk about, we're going to talk about oral antibiotic bioavailability in general. So now we've talked about all that basic stuff.
Yes, that was the basics, That wasn't at all complicated.
Basic science, let's say.
Yeah.
Calum, what are the differences between oral and IV sort of antibiotics?
Yeah, so I guess oral antibiotics by nature need to be soluble. So you want, so that you can actually absorb them. They need to be acid stable so they can get past your stomach acid. And they need to be lipid soluble so they can get through the gut easily.
Probably lipid soluble, but
preferably. Yeah, these are all preferences. Whereas IV are, it doesn't matter if they're, so they can be acid labile because they don't need to go through the stomach acid. They don't need to have high solubility, so they can be low solubility. And they can be lipophobic. So it doesn't really matter. It's more important thinking about what an oral antibiotic needs to be. So it's got a lot more hurdles to get through than an IV one, which is basically it's got an Uber straight to where it needs to go.
Yeah. And I suppose actually that there are antibiotics which are given orally but also given IV, and they can be, they don't need to be acid labile. But the kind of antibiotics that are only available IV, it tends to be because they're acid labile or lipophobic, and so the oral route is just not suitable.
You might have different formulations.
For example,
So obviously a lot of like drug approval, getting a drug formulation ready is about, do you have a coating on your tablet to protect the drug inside, or can it be as a liquid? So it's often that frustrating.
I've not talked about this here actually, but absorption can be high by enteric coating, which is aspirin and omeprazole and all that are enteric coating.
So that's obviously a lot
to
more,
make them more likely to pass the stomach. Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of complexity about how do you get drugs suitable and make them up in terms of formulation, but there's some general principles.
Totally. So here's the meat of the episode, Callum. What drugs are highly bioavailable? And first, I think I need to define what that means. And so I think of highly bioavailable as this. If the oral route is available, those drugs will be just as good orally as if they were IV. And as a very general rule of thumb, anything more than 70% bioavailable is probably going to be just as good as if you had given it intravenously. Now, that's not based on any hard science or anything, Callum, but the very rough cutoff is at 70, basically because ciprofloxacin's bioavailability is 70, and there's reasonable data suggests that it's as good IV as it is oral. So if it's more than 70% bioavailable, it's probably good to go. And once you go below that, the next drug that I've got in the list here is penicillin V, or phenoxymethyl penicillin. It's 60% bioavailable, and it's not really considered to be highly bioavailable when people talk about it. So I've what I did, Callum, was I went through every drug that is available in the BNF. So apologies to non-UK listeners. There will be some drugs that you use all the time that are not featured in this list.
Yeah, all those oral cephalosporins you've got that we don't get.
Exactly.
Or carbapenems.
And although cefadroxil is available in the UK, I didn't include it. But actually, its bioavailability is 90%, so same as cefalexin. And then what I did was I sought out the bioavailability. Where I could, I included the bioavailability as stated in the UCAST document for that drug. And those ones that were in UCAST, I've bolded, Callum. So you'll see there that minocycline is bold, but linezolid isn't. That's because linezolid's bioavailability wasn't stated in UCAST, and so I found another source.
There's James referring to a table in the prep notes, which can be found in the link on the episode description.
And so, listeners, I've applied a traffic light nomenclature. So green is highly bioavailable, orange is intermediate, and red is not very. But there are curiosities down at the bottom of that table that I'll tell you about shortly, Callum. So we'll just list them.
We're going to alternate? Or what do we? Do
you know what, actually? We finished our Nobbling the Non-Fermenters miniseries, but I'm sure the loyal listeners would love an alternating reading of the drug and then the bioavailability as a number, because that will make them feel like this is a continuation.
I think there's quite a few listeners that can't tell us apart very easily, right?
God, is that true?
When,
do you think?
When we do an alternate, I've heard this. So when we do an alternating list, do they think it's just one person speaking?
Oh my God.
Speaking a different voice. Oh my God.
We have very different accents, Callum.
Totally different. We are from one end of Scotland and I'm from the other. I'll start, because then you get to say linezolid. How about that?
Fine.
I sacrifice myself. Levofloxacin, 100.
Linezolid, 100.
Minocycline, 95.
Nitrofurantoin, 95 or greater.
Trimethoprim, 90 or greater.
Cotrimoxazole, 90 or greater.
Doxycycline, 90 or greater.
Metronidazole, 90 or greater.
Moxifloxacin, 90.
Clindamycin, 90.
Cefalexin, 90.
Tetracyclines, 80 to 90.
Chloramphenicol, 85.
Amoxicillin, 80 to 85.
Amoxicillin clavulanate, 80 to 85, / 64.
Pivmecillinam, 75.
Ciprofloxacin, 70.
And now we're on to the moderately bioavailable. Penicillin V, or phenoxymethyl penicillin, 60.
Flucloxacillin, 60.
Shout out to Luke. Clarithromycin, 55.
Now we're on to the...
lowly bioavailable, yeah.
Cefuroxime acetyl, 40.
Cefixime, 40.
Azithromycin, 37.
Phosphomycin, 33 to 44.
Erythromycin, 20 to 45.
And that's it. So like I say, anything bold comes from UCAS. Everything else I've gotten from, usually the SPC of the drug is found on medicines.org.uk. So
summary of product characteristics, is that what that says?
Yeah,
like?
I think so.
Yeah.
So when I look at that table column, A, it's a thing of beauty. Do you know? I think this should be put on every wall at every hospital with a poster that says, points to it and says, prescribe orally, you idiots. But B, we've got loads of highly bioavailable options, don't we? Not so many beta-lactams, like enough to be going on with. It's good, right? What?
I'm just laughing about the next bit.
At what?
What's coming up next?
Oh, fine. Well, I'll just jump to it, will I, Callum? This is, listeners, this has tickled Callum Pink when he saw this. So when I'm teaching this to the medical students, what I like to say is that your highly bioavailable antibiotics tend to start with a C. So, another alternating list for you loyal listeners. Cefalexin.
Chloramphenicol.
Ciprofloxacin and the other quinolones.
Clindamycin.
Comoxiclav and amoxicillin.
Cotrimoxazole.
Clever old linezolid.
Crusher of clostridia, metronidazole.
And cyclines of tetra.
So you can see that all those antibiotics very clearly begin with C.
Absolutely. I mean,
we're not taking any further questions at this time.
Thank you very much, Callum.
If you have any questions or comments about that list, please do not email us at idiotpodcasting@gmail.com.
So not in that list are things like trimethoprim, nitrofurantoin, and piperacillin, but those are more, I consider them more UTI drugs. And so the next table that I've got is for the sake of learning,
I can fix the list to include those three.
Can you?
Yeah.
How?
I'm just going to end at the end. Cystitis drugs. Trimethoprim, nitrofurantoin, piperacillin.
God damn it, that's amazing, Callum.
Thank you, that's the best feedback I've had so far this year.
Oh, that's really good. I am included. I'm going to do that, actually, the next time I'm teaching this. Fine. And so I've included here a breakdown of the drugs that we've just made by class. All of the anti-DNA agents are highly bioavailable, so your quinolones and cotrimoxazole and trimethoprim. For protein synthesis, it's a bit fuzzier, so basically the macrolides are not highly bioavailable, everything else is. And then the beta-lactams, it's really, for highly bioavailable, it's really just amox, cefalexin, and piperacillin. The clavulanic acid would be considered medium bioavailability. But actually, you don't need an awful lot of clavulanic acid to get this maximal effect. So even though its absorption is only about 64%, it's probably you should still consider co-amoxiclav to be highly bioavailable when you're using it, if you know what I mean. And the last table I've got here is a list sorted by indication, where I've included the drugs that we mostly use for each indication, and again, colour coding by bioavailability for chest, skin, and urine. So that's something that the listener can take a look at, you know, if they so choose, in the prep notes.
So what you've done is you've said for each antibiotic, and then its bioavailability, and then you've put a plus next to it if it can be used for that. That's organ system infection.
Yeah, and basically it's what I would use for those organ systems. So say for chest, you could use co-amoxiclav. I would not. It is optional. It is something that can be used. And then cefalexin, chloramphenicol, clarithromycin, cotrimoxazole, levofloxacin, the mino or doxycycline, and moxifloxacin. So those are things that you could use for skin soft tissue infection. There's a bunch of those there that I wouldn't really want to use, but you could do it.
So James, are there any caveats to absorption?
Callum, as a matter of fact, there are. So the first is to point out that amoxicillin absorption is saturable. And for the average person, after 750 milligrams, no more of that is likely to be getting in to the patient. And for cefalexin as well, the maximum amount you can absorb orally is about 4 grams. I just looked this up in the BNF. We were discussing using high-dose cefalexin for skin and soft tissue in our ambulatory setting. And, you know, the maximum that you can give is 1.5 grams four times a day. So 6 grams a day of cephalexin. So
as in that's the maximum listed in the BNF?
Yeah, yeah. But the range is high because as you can give cephalexin like 250 twice a day or something like that. And it'll cure your UTI. But we're using it for skin soft tissue. So the, you know, whereas with UTIs, it will concentrate into the urine at high enough levels. With skin soft tissue, you rely on the plasma levels to do that. We were looking, and yeah, you can give 6 grams, but actually most people won't be able to absorb more than 4 grams in a 24-hour period. So bear that in mind when you're thinking about how to use. We tend to use, when I'm using the high dose, I call high dose something like 1 gram 3 times a day. Yeah, that's what I would use. And then lastly, we need to talk about the macrolides, Callum, because if you go back and look at the first table that I put together, clarithromycin's bioavailability is about 55. And azithromycin's 37, and erythromycin's 20 to 45.
Yeah, that surprised me a bit. Because often when we're saying colmoxiclav and clary, we're always like, there's no reason to give the clary IV, just give it oral. And
but you are still entitled to say that, Callum.
Yeah, but because you're like, immediately you'd be like, oh, it's not well absorbed orally, so we need to give it IV.
Yeah, that's not true, though. And so there are exceptions to this. Bioavailability is not everything, is what I'm saying, because distribution matters. And the macrolides distribute disproportionately to the intracellular space, which is where all of their pathogens happen to be. And so if you think about your respiratory atypicals, they're all intracellular pathogens, Legionella, Mycoplasma, Chlamydophila. You might want something that concentrates into the intracellular space, and macrolides do that. And so there's sort of circumstantial data, I think, for clarithromycin, that giving IV or giving orally doesn't make a difference. So that 55% that's absorbed, that's enough to give the maximal effect.
Yeah.
And so I'm not sure that I would say with the erythromycin that's the case, but for azithro and clary, it does seem to be fine. Yeah.
So the rationale for giving macrolides orally and it being okay is because they concentrate intracellularly. So if you're treating something that's an extracellular pathogen, then do we need to be worried about giving clarithromycin?
Maybe. I don't know. I don't think I've got the data to support an assumption one way or the other, Callum.
Yeah. But I guess your point is that although we've just spoken through oral bioavailability, that isn't the sum total of the story. And yeah, all of it matters. And it also matters where the organism is in the body, like what body site you're trying to get to. And it also matters about other bug factors.
Yeah, and that brings me to my last point, Callum, which is that some of these UTI drugs don't have very good absorption at all. Fosfomycin, a third of the oral dose. So if you're given 3 grams, only 1 is getting in. You know, that's not very good at all. But fosfomycin concentrates into the urine. And so do, you know, a bunch of the other ones, pivmecillinam, trimethoprim, they're all highly bioavailable as well. They get into the urine, and so they're useful for UTI. But even the highly bioavailable ones that I mentioned, so nitrofurantoin, trimethoprim, pivmecillinam, they don't get great plasma levels.
Yeah.
So for that reason, they are discounted for the treatment of pyelonephritis, because in order to get good kidney levels, you need to get good plasma levels. Yeah. But they're useful for UTI. So even though they're highly bioavailable, you wouldn't necessarily want to use them for a systemic infection.
Which comes back to the whole, when you look in guidelines and they say, they give a different recommendation. So they'll say that you can use this for cystitis, but you can't use it for a more complicated UTI, you know, like pyelonephritis or similar, because in that case, you want to have a more systemic treatment. So the fact that it concentrates to the urinary tract may be fine, but you know, that's why you might see different agents recommended for different conditions, because it comes okay.
And I guess I wanted to finish off this episode, Callum, by talking about the effects of food, because I think this is a cause of some confusion, and certainly I wasn't clear on everything before I started researching for this episode. So I went back to those SPCs and just saw that for each drug, what the recommendations were or what the effective absorption was. I didn't look at the pills, the patient information leaflets, because usually they said the same thing regardless of the evidence, which is take with food. And I think that's because when you do that, you reduce the chances of GI side effects with what the drug is. But that didn't necessarily correlate with the effects of absorption. Yeah. So I've divided them into three categories here. One is take on an empty stomach. One is take with food, and the other is no recommendation at all. And below this is another table that we're not going through, which has the very precise recommendations and then a couple of other notes for each individual antibiotic. So, for example, there's a note for the tetracyclines that, if you take them with dairy or antacids, then the drug will bind the metal that's in the antacids, form an insoluble complex, and then absorption will be impaired. We've covered that a little bit in the pregnancy episode, but tetracyclines chelate metal ions, and their absorption is affected by that. But anyway, returning to the more simple table, the things that you would want to take on an empty stomach would be penicillin, flucloxacillin, azithromycin, and fosfomycin. And when we say an empty stomach, we mean either take an hour before food or 2 hours after food. So that's what an empty stomach means. There's ones that you want to take with a meal, and so that would be comoxiclav, erythromycin, metronidazole, or nitrofurantoin. And most of those are to minimize side effects as opposed to having a significant effect on absorption. So you see that amoxicillin is in the it doesn't matter group. It's because the GI side effects that you sometimes get with clavulanic acid can be mitigated with food. And then the third category is none, and that's everything else that I've not mentioned so far. So amoxicillin, pivmicillin, amkeflexin, tetracyclines, clarithromycin, clindamycin, linezolid, cotrimoxazole, ultramethrin, and quinolones.
Yeah.
So I think depending on your setting, that absorption stuff and how to take with food, sometimes that will be dealt with by a pharmacist who's counselling the patient. It's worthwhile to know a little bit about, which drugs in particular need to be taken with food and without.
So obviously some of that is quite in-depth and maybe a bit complicated. And generally speaking, when we're prescribing an antibiotic, we'll be given a dose recommendation by BNF or guideline or whatnot. And so this is maybe explaining some of the rationale behind some of those decisions. So of all the stuff that you've just talked about, what is the key message that you would have for people?
I think the key message is the thing that I said at the start when we were talking about the table with the traffic light system. If it is highly bioavailable, I would push for an oral switch as soon as practicable. I basically never prescribe these drugs IV unless the oral route is compromised. Mm. And I, furthermore, Callum, think that a lot of the time a drug will be started IV because people are worried about sepsis and things like that. And then after the first dose, you're not contributing anything. So I think after the first dose of IV, really giving extra doses IV are not really contributing that much. And yet we have this dogma in our heads, A, that IV is superior to oral, and I think we've contributed to a little bit to knocking that down, but B, that you need to give IVs for a couple of days and then switch when the patient's better onto an oral dose, which might be a lower dose. And I don't hold to that. So I have a couple of patients under my care right now. I'm on service at the moment for general medicine in NAIDOSH Royal Infirmary Southern Wing. And there's a couple of people on cotrimoxazole, and I'm using that as a... don't know really what the infection is. They need broad spectrum cover, but they're old, so I don't want to give a broad spectrum beta-lactam. So they're on Cotrim and they're on an IV, but the second they start being able to swallow and eat and drink again, I'm switching them to pills because I don't believe that Cotrimoxazole 960 BD is more effective IV than it is orally. So that's an example. And there was somebody who had, they were put on comoxiclav and I let that happen for... it already happened, basically. But then I switched them to orals when I saw them, and the juniors that I was rounding with were like, don't you need to wait a couple of days? And so I said, I don't think so. I think that as long as the patient is absorbing and they're not in septic shock, then oral medication should be fine for this patient. So that's where I think... because every time that you give a dose of antibiotics, there's an opportunity for stewardship. And reducing the course length so that they're exposed to less antibiotic, that's one way to do it. And oral switching is another way to do it.
Wow. I feel like I've just had a one-to-one tutoring session from the pharmacist himself, Jay McCrae. So thanks. I feel like we should talk about something I know more about at some point, so that I feel like
to redress the balance. Yeah, I should say there at this point before we go to the outro, if anybody disagrees with any of this stuff or knows that I've made an error with this, let me know. idiotspodcasting@gmail.com, and I'll do my best to correct it.
Unless it's related to the mnemonic, in which case we don't want to hear.
The mnemonic is enshrined.
Pillar of practice. Forever.
So, yeah.
Clever old Lynn Neslid.
Cyclones of Tetra.
Thank you for listening to the Idiots Podcast, the UK's premier infectious disease podcast. We are supported by the British Infection Association, but they do not have creative control over the episode content, so please don't blame them if we get something wrong.
Questions, comments, suggestions? Why don't you send them in to idiotspodcasting@gmail.com? Have a 5-star review in your pocket? Calum and I would love to have it. Please drop it in your podcast player of choice. We tweet at @idiots_pod, and if you want to donate to support the show, there's a link to do so in the description. But until next time, I'm Jane.
I'm Calum.
See you then.
Now that the episode's done, we hope you learned and had lots of fun. So go forth and treat people with some of what you now know.